very most important people in the field of quantum gravity the last several decades. He is a co-inventor of loop quantum gravity, a co-inventor of spin foam models, which is the subject of his talk today. He's also very broad. He's made a proposal for the foundations of quantum mechanics, relational quantum mechanics. He has speculated about the cosmological constant provocatively, and many other things. He is the author of the main textbook in quantum gravity from Cambridge University Press, and recently has a philosophical historical book on first scientists. And he is also the author of a couple of other books that I won't mention. And so it's a great pleasure to have Carlo here. Carlo is going to talk about spin foam amplitudes, or what, amplitudes? Amplitudes in quantum gravity.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you very much. And thank you all for being here. This full house isn't a single empty. In fact, there's exactly as many chairs as person. No, minus one. Sorry. Wait, consider. Okay. Thanks. It's great to be here at PI. I was at PI when PI was baby in the little brick building there when it started. It was a PI then, later a much bigger building. Now it comes much bigger building. It's wonderful to see babies grown and being back. And I'm going to talk about quantum gravity. I'm going to talk about loop quantum gravity. And this lecture, I'm going to tell you about what has happened in the last 3 or 4 years, because a lot has happened in the last 3 or 4 years. So there have been a big jump in the understanding of this tentative way to do quantum gravity. And I hope in 1 hour to give you a sense, not certain the details, but a sense of what is happening, why I'm excited about it. Let me start by clarifying what is the question being addressed to avoid you sort of thinking in the wrong direction. The question being addressed is the following one. Is there a consistent quantum theory whose classical limit is general relativity? Okay. The reason I say that, because the question being addressed is only this question and no more. And in particular, a consistent quantum theory. So nothing is here in what I'm going to say relevant for uniqueness or even for correctness. We know this is the correct theory of Planck scale. No. So the question is, in a sense, a, in quotes, mathematical question. Can we define something which is a genuine quantum theory, consistent with the principle of quantum mechanics, such that its limit is generative? And then, of course, consistent essentially means perturbative quantum general relativity is inconsistent because of the infinities, so means there are no incontrollable infinities that cannot be controlled. And finally, I want a theory which might be the correct one. So in 4 dimensions, Lorentzian, and with the standard microcouplings, which means that, something which is not addressed at all is unification. Of course, it might be that the answer to the question is no, there isn't any, unless you include unification. Many people suspect, but it might be that this is not the case. And many people used to think that the strong interaction could not have been understood unless one could understand many other problems and go through unification. If that opinion had prevailed, we wouldn't have QCD. QCD is a consistent description of string interaction with its standard couplings, so to say. So the question is, can the same be done with general relativity? Okay, that's the question. And what I'm going to do is to give you a in point two, a definition of a theory. So I'll write the basic equations of the theory and a set of theorems that have been proven that say that we are more or less close or most or less far from the objective of defining this theory. I will just, in the last part, discuss won't anticipate, to which extent we can say yes to that question or to which extent we can say no. But before actually just start writing down some equations which are at first sight meaningless and complicated, let me say something about the general structure that we expect from the theory, because this is supposed to give generativity, so it has the symmetries of generativity, general covariance, and so on and so forth, which is not common in quantum field theory, so this is going to be a general covariant quantum field theory. So we need to develop a framework, a way of thinking that is appropriate to that. So I'll start with a few slides, very elementary, extremely elementary, telling you what is a framework in which you can think at a generally covariant quantum field theory, so to say. And let me start. It's a lot of equations, but you all know these equations very well, so it's just to remind you something. Let me start for something completely trivial. This, suppose you have a quantum system. This is Hamiltonian. These are the eigenstates of some configuration space operator, the position operator. And this is a transition amplitude that you all know very well. And we learned from Feynman that can be thought as obtained from a path integral. Now, one of the advantages of this representation is that if you're in a regime where you can where quantum mechanical effect is small, then you can think that H is small, so this is dominated by the saddle point. So the transition amplitude is just given by the exponential of the action on the physical trajectory that solves the equation of motion, determined by the initial point q prime at time, initial and final point q and q prime at time t and t prime, and this is the Hamilton function of the system, right? The Hamilton function of the system, I remind you, is the value of the action on that particular trajectory, which is determined by the initial and final point. Of course, if there are more than one, then there's more than one subtle point. If there isn't any, there isn't any subtle point. Now, second observation, completely trivial, Feynman wrote this by, in fact, when he did it, the way he derived it and the meaning he gave to the path integral is as a limit of a multiple integral. So the idea is to take this time interval, t initial, t final, chop it in n steps, insert a resolution of units, and each one of these gives an integral. So you have a multiple integral. And then if you work the math here, you see you can approximate this the elementary evolution operators with exponentials of elementary little action. So you get a discretization of the action. And if you have a discretization of the action, vice versa, you can define a level n approximation of this quantity here. So once you have these transition amplitudes at level n, do not confuse the classical limit, which is the subtle point approximation of this multiple integral here, which gives the Hamilton function of the discretized system, from the continuum limit, which is just taking n to infinity, which gives the correct transition functions of the, okay? So this is just elementary, but it's for setting a few things. So the structure, I'll come over and over on this square again, of the theory is the following. You can define a discretized path integral where you define discretized quantum theory. You take h to 0, h bar to 0, and you get the discretized classical theory. You take n to infinity, and you get the transition amplitudes. Now, comment. This, I didn't put just n equal to infinity here. I put n equal to infinity and a to infinity, and a to 0. Why? Because let's do this in a concrete, simple example. This is a harmonic oscillator. This is a discretization. So I take the time interval, the given finite time interval, I chop it in parts. So I have a elementary time step A, the lattice spaces of QCD. Then the discretization of this thing here. And notice that capital N, the number of steps, enters twice in this. Enters because little n goes from 1 to capital N, of course, and enters in A. A is T over N, okay? the interval divided by N. Now, it's common to absorb, it's not essential for the argument, but it's common, that's what is done all over, to absorb this A by redefining Q, the variables, after all, in the quantum theory, these are just integration variables. So If you rescale A, if you rescale your variable by putting A in the belly of the new variables, then you get an expression in which you don't see A anymore, but of course A is still there, because to get this expression you have to, this omega here, this frequency, is the previous frequency multiplied by the lattice spacing. So this means that when you go to the limit, the continuous limit, you have to take n to infinity and this omega to zero, which is a critical point in the discretized system. And that's what we all learn at school, right? You go discretization and you recover the continuous theory by going to a critical point, by sending one of the coupling constants of the frequency here, or the mass, to a critical value where your discrete system scales up to give back a continuous system. Okay? This is what we learn at school. So the limit is n going to zero and a going to zero, or omega going to zero. But, and that's the first but. Suppose instead of writing the dynamic of the harmonic oscillator with the standard action, I use this action here, which many of you will recognize is just the parameterized action of the same system. So I have two variables now, q evolving in tau and t evolving in tau. And this Lagrangian here, it's a density in tau, so the action is invariant under change of tau. So this is a generally covariant action for the harmonic oscillator. I have Q and T equal ground as dependent variables, and the dependent parameter is tau, but in fact, there's a gauge invariance for arbitrary polarization of tau. Suppose I start from that, it's an equally good classical description of the system, that's a little bit more involved. And I do the same thing, and then something remarkable happened. Let me do the most naive discretization of this action, which is this one, and look. A is here from the d tau, A is square here from this, A is linear here from that. So A square downstairs, A square disappears. A and A disappears, so this thing is equal to that. There's no A in the Lagrangian time step. The only place where N enters is in the upper value of little n, which goes from 1 to big N. Okay? And I want to insist that, because somehow the rest of the talk will depend on this little observation here. So if I want to do the path integral, I can still change variables here and absorb stuff into Q and get a much simpler expression. But look, now the new variables don't know anything about N. They know about a scale here. This is M omega H bar is a scale. So the theory has a scale. I go to dimensionless thing, but there is a scale hidden in there. But what scale is it? Well, this is the scale of the quanta, right? This length is the size of the vacuum fluctuations of the harmonic oscillator. So there is a physical scale there, and the theory sits on a physical scale. And when you write it in a discretized form, all this is dimensionless, but there is a scale which connects to the physical variables. But the n doesn't know anything about this scale, and the only place where capital N comes in is in the number of steps you take. So when you write the path integral now, as a multiple variable in Q and T, there is no critical point to be taken. There's no parameter to be taken to a value. The only thing you have to do is to compute more and more at a higher value of n, so the larger and larger value of the n that you put out here. So the moral is the following. If you have a system evolving in time, a standard system evolving in time, the continuum limit of the discretization is obtained by taking the number of steps to infinity and a coupling constant to a critical value. While if you have a general covariant system, and unless you by hand introduce a discretization, a scale in the discretization, which sometimes you do, but you don't have to, and always you can find a way of not doing it, the continuum limit is obtained just taking the number of steps to infinity. And typical example, lattice QCD, where, as you know, I mean, you do the calculation, you have to scale A to zero, you have to scale the coupling constant in front of the action to its critical value to get physics, while in regular calculus, which is a typical discretization that satisfies this invariance here, there's no parameter there. There's no scale in regular calculus. You have just the variables, you integrate all the variables, there's nothing to tune to get the continuous limit. You just do take n larger and larger. So n going to zero, and that's it. Second observation about the parameterized system, I'll just flash here. You see, what I've done here is consider, in the example system, I consider Q and T on the same ground, so I just call them x. And the Hamilton function, which is the classical limit of the quantum transition amplitude, if you want, a priori you would expect, since it is an integral from tau to tau prime of the Lagrange, the Lagrangian in the solution of equation motion go from there, you would expect that depend on tau and tau prime. But in fact, it's a simple calculation to see that this doesn't depend on tau and tau prime. Okay? So the Hamilton function of a general covariant system is a generally covariant object. The Hamilton function of generativity will know nothing about coordinates. We just know about the boundary geometry. Okay? Later on. So the transition amplitude discretized at level n, which is integrating on dqn and dtn, in the classical limit, here it is, in the classical limit, it will go to the classical discretized general covariant theory. And in the continuum limit, where in the continuum limit, there's no critical phenomenon involved, there's just number of steps increasing, will go to the actual physical theory. Now, this is not a stupid observation. You see, if you have to go to a critical point, then you have to go to this critical point. When you're far from this critical point, the system you're describing has nothing to do with your physical system. Here, this n really gives an approximation order by order, an expansion order by order to the actual quantity. And let me actually try to convince you of that with a super simple example. This is a transition amplitude for a harmonic oscillator. Okay, it's easy to compute in the Euclidean because it's easy to plot. Here it is plotted as function of QF, the continuous line. The points here are the value of the corresponding WN approximated for n equal 2. So for n equal 2 in the harmonic oscillator, in this regime here, you already have a good transition amplitude, right? And of course, the approximation is good somewhere, bad somewhere else. And this is where it's good. So this, where these are the boundary values. So when the boundary values satisfy these inequalities here, you don't have to go up in n to get your transition amplitude. Just the first order in n are good. So this gives the how good is the approximation, how good is the, oops, sorry. This gives how good is the approximation continuous limit, and this gives how good is approximation in the classical limit, right? Because the classical approximation is good to the extent in which your energy is large compared to the zero point energy. So you know what you're doing. Well, the problem is to do all this for general relativity.
Can I just ask about the previous slide? That calculation shows the result of your tau. Discretization, or
the points are this integral here. The result of this integral here for n equal 2.
The generally covariant one.
The generally covariant one.
Okay. You have to compute it numerically.
In that particular case, I can do it analytically, but this is an harmonic oscillator. I can do everything analytically. As soon as I'm a little bit more complicated than harmonic oscillator.
But it's different than the standard harmonic.
It's definitely completely different than the standard.
So did you compute this graph for a standard harmonic oscillator if I fix A and do it as a function of n?
You get nothing at all because you get straight lines in the. So if you want to do with
I
not
just want
with,
to compare the two approximations.
Yeah, I should have put the two. If you want to do just with integration in Q and not T. Then you have to go to, essentially, you have to follow the trajectory with many little steps. You have to get as many little steps for the sinus to be approximated.
I'm just interested to see if your way is better.
It's infinitely better.
It converges better with
it. It converges infinitely better. This
but
is,
you didn't compare them.
Yeah, I didn't compare. I should have. Okay. But let me also say that this integral here, then, is twice as many variables, is much more complicated. Okay? In fact, my QCD friends in Marseille said, oh, great, let's do it for QCD. But then you have to formulate the QCD with many more variables. Essentially, you have to allow your time steps to become dynamical.
Sure.
And the dynamics itself chooses the position such that energy is conserved, so such that it's sort of as good as possible for. Okay. Good. So now I want to do it for gravity. If we can do that for gravity, we have a path toward a quantum theory of gravity. So this is the action of general relativity. I do here for pure gravity, for simplicity in principle, one can put matter terms, so just be, but the main message would just be more complicated to go through, and nothing substantial would change. So this is the action of general relativity. I need to put a boundary term, right? Because I'm just computing path integrals between an initial value and a final value. So we know in GR that the correct action needs boundary term, okay, essentially. The Hamilton function is easy because it's easy. It's easy in the sense that, of course, the solution inside will have a zero Ricci tensor, therefore zero Ricci scalar, so this term is zero. So you only end up with this one. So this is the Hamilton function, but it's not at all an easy quantity in the sense that this is just a function of Q. And the extensive curvature here, it's the non-local, the one determined non-locally by the metric, by, you know, fix the metric on the boundary, solve the equation of motion, find the four-dimensional solution inside, compute the extensive curvature on the boundary. So it's not something with known explicitly, obviously, because we you know the Hamilton function when you know the solution of the equation of motion, which we don't, of course, in gravity.
Sorry, but you're not really going to use the Hamilton function, are you?
I'm going to use it conceptually to see what I'm...
It's only the classical approximation.
That's
you can only, the action only equals that on the equations of motion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You will see in which sense I use it. I'm not using the explicit form. The explicit depends on S of Q at all. Now, is there a discretization? Is there a decent discretization of that? Yes, there is one, very well known and very well studied, with a regular discretization. So you take general relativity, you take this piece of space-time, you chop it with a discretization, with a triangulation. Delta is a triangulation, and you describe the metric with the length of the bounds of the triangulation, which is L. And then what the regular showed is that this action here is nicely approximated. So this converges of that when the discretization is refined by this very simple expression here. This is the sum of the triangles of the triangulation, of the area of the triangle, and the deficit angle going around the triangles, which are two quantities which can be computed with just elementary geometry. If you have a discretization with a flat pieces, you just use some geometry and you compute the area and the deficit angle. So the regular Hamilton function is the analog of this thing here for the discretized theory. So it can be worked out, and it, not surprisingly, it turned out to be a sum of the boundary triangles, of the area of the boundary triangles, and the deficit angle of the boundary triangles. And we know when this approximation is good to that, and it is when we're looking at length small compared to the curvature scale. So given boundary geometry, you sort of figure out what is a relevant curvature scale, and then you want your elementary discrete steps to be small compared to the curvature scale. So if you're very far to flatness, you can use big chunk of almost flat thing. If there's a lot of waves, you need a little small. Good. So suppose this is a structure of quantum gravity. Here we want the Hamilton function of general relativity. Here we want the Hamilton function of the regular theory, discretization. And here we want to define some appropriate objects such that in the classical limit they go to the Hamilton function of the regular theory, and they are as good defined as possible. And this C, for the moment, just look at, imagine is a triangulation, define a certain triangulation. And appropriately, they should convert in some sense to something which are the exact transition amplitude of quantum gravity, which of course we'll never hope to write down in closed form. This is not Young-Mill theory in any form. I mean, this is a complicated theory we're not going to write. So that at most, we can have that with some approximation scheme. Now, notice a few things. First, actually, one thing, because all these comments refer to the same point. There is no critical parameter to tune here. There's no critical point. There's just this limit to be considered. And there's no infinite normalization. There's a physical scale on which the theory sits, which not surprisingly is going to be h bar g, the Planck scale, like the harmonic oscillator citron omega h bar. Okay, so this is like condensed matter away from critical points. You have a structure at some scale. You hope to have a structure. I haven't given this to you. But if this works, you have a structure of some scale. And you look at a much larger scale, and that's it, without any fixed point to look at. And if you think for a moment, string theory, and by string theory, I mean here the one that works well. I mean the in-10-dimension perturbative string theory with this supersymmetry and so on. It does give a theory of quantum gravity, right? We're not totally happy because it is in 10-dimension. We don't know how to come down and so on and so forth. But it does give us a good theory of quantum gravity. How does it work? It works without renormalization. The amplitudes are not renormalized appropriately like in QED or in QCD. They are finite, period. So there is in the genus expansion, in the H-bar expansion of string theory, there is no scaling. There is no infinite renormalization. It's not a quantum field theory in the sense in which QED and QCD are quantum field theories, because you imagine this infinite tower of degrees of freedom of arbitrary momentum, right? It sits on a scale, and which is a Planck scale or the string tension scale, and from that you just compute, period. Nothing to do. So again, it's like condensed matter away from critical phenomena. So quantum gravity, string theory suggests, and the theory which I'm going to define in next slide also suggests, loop quantum gravity, is like condensed matter away from criticality, unlikely QED and QCD or Blaschel-Salam, which is defined by critical. Now, in the next slide, I'm going to define this theory, finally. I'm just write the equations, just flash a little bit of history, only to tell you how we got there. It's a long story, right? It started in the late 50s with writing this famous sum over geometries that later was developed by Hawkins and company. The Regge calculus, which I used in the early 60s, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is sort of the equation of quantum gravity, if we could make sense of it, was written in the early 60s. And I'll use later on a lot solidly the spin geometry theorem at Penrose, which in the 70s. So this is sort of the prehistory. The actual loop quantum gravity development started with Ashikar complex variables and started in 88 with the loop quantum gravity. Here, I've obviously not put the names of all the people who have worked on that, but only the names of the people who are here in the perimeter. Because Lee was sort of a major person in this stage here. And 10 years later, in the main result of the old loop quantum gravity, canonical loop quantum gravity, which is the fact that the geometrical spectral problem of the geometrical operators can be solved. So you get this discreteness of area and volume for these operators here. I'll get to that later on. The covariant version of loop quantum gravity, which is sort of a way of doing this, also started in the middle 90s. But the actual theory, which I'm defining next slide, was written in 2008, and remarkably, independently by different groups. And by people here in perimeter, in Marseille, in the UK, using different formalism. And it turns out that in the Lorentzian case, all these different things converge in one theory, which is the one in the next slide, which can be written, in fact, in many different ways, but is the same, but they're equivalent. The theorem, which I mentioned, that relates that to Regge theory is a couple of years later, so it took some time, and it was worked out first in England by Barrett and company and by various other people, and Eugenio, who is here, contribute to it. Well, here, of course, Laurent Friedel is the person who worked here on the actual definition of the theory. So the definition of the theory should have his name. And the finiteness of the amplitude, which is the main result, that's why I'm talking to you, is last year. So the novelty here I'm talking about is last 3 or 4 years. So again, this is what I have to define this object. Right? If I give you a definition of these objects, that's a tentative quantum theory of gravity. So these are these objects. These are the WC. They're defined by these three equations. Okay? So I'm going to tell you a little bit what are the symbols. I'm not going into details of computing anything. This was object. Well, I'll give you some theorems that have been proven about this WC. So what is WC? It's something which depends on a C is a two complex. So think of triangulation. If you have a triangulation, four-dimensional triangulation of space-time, It's more convenient for doing the game here to look at it in the dual. So C is a dual to complex to the triangulation. So you have a for simplex, the element of the triangulation, you put a point in the middle and you call it vertex. For every two simple which are touch one another, you put a line and you call it edge. This is it. And then for each triangle of the triangulation, you go around with something we call a face and we call it F. So you have this structure, which is just sort of lattice QCD. Think of a lattice QCD, except that it's not cubic. It's just tetrahedrical, simplicial. And you associate a number, which is no boundary, just a pure number. If it's a boundary, it depends on some h on the boundary. The boundary is a graph here. So some h are group variables, SU2 group variables. So I'll come to that later. So what is this number? It's an integration of an SC2 variable associated to each vertex and face here. Then there is a delta function that glue these group variables around each face and a product of amplitude 1 for each vertex. So the amplitude of 1 of each vertex is a sum of SU2 representation, spins, an integral for SL to C, in fact, an integral FL to C for each edge that come out of the vertex, and then a trace. One trace for each face arriving at the vertex. And the trace is what? It has some SU2 element of SL2C element. And it's some representation. So these elements are not group elements. They are the matrix element of this group element in the representation. But of course, this is SU2 and this is SL2C. So what is happening here is happening there is a map Y from SU2 representations to SL2C representations, which is defined here. So SU2 representations are labeled by a spin and live in some Hilbert spaces HJ, which you know very well from angular momentum theory. SL2C representation, unitary SL2C representation, so the infinite measurements, are labeled by two quantum numbers. And this map sends a representation J into the representation with the quantum numbers J, gamma J, where gamma is a number, a parameter in the theory, three parameter theory, the Inertzi or Inertzi-Barbero parameter, which I'll illustrate where it comes from later on. And that's a map. So this is the definition of the theory. That's all. Like, you know, if I did generativity, I could write the Einstein equation and say, well, this is it. It's nothing more than that. Or if I do QED, I could give you the Feynman rules, and this is it. So these are the Feynman rules of the theory. Now, this is without cosmological constant. With cosmological constants is a little bit more complicated, so I'm not going to write explicitly. I'll just mention what it is. Essentially, with cosmological constant, you have to replace this trace here with the trace of a Q-deformed group, of the corresponding quantum group. And there is some mathematic in which I'm not going to go, which is related to the Vasilius-Concievich invariant. So don't want to go in complications. OK, so that's the theory. What are the results? What am I telling you about this theory? I'll tell you four things. The first one, which is in my historical thing was the last line and was proved last year, is that these amplitudes are finite. Or precisely, sorry, the ones with cosmological constants are finite. And finite, I don't mean normalizable, or they're just finite, they're numbers. So all these integrals converge.
Sorry, okay? Where is h bar?
Since you ask now, it's better that I. It's here. The dimensionless variables have h bar inside. So this is a theory written in dimensionless terms. Let me go back. And when you map this to physical dimension, you will see in a moment that. Where it is, this J is an area. So you're summing over areas in units L Planck equal 1. So large areas with respect to its bar means large J. So it's hidden into that. Of course, it's pure gravity. So H bar stays with G together. They're always. So this amplitude is finite. And that's the main message. The finite both at large areas and small areas, in the infrared and the ultraviolet. See why. And second, of course, that's what we wanted. The classical limit of the vertex amplitudes converges approximately to the Reggie-Hamilton function. So in other words, this limit here, it's good. For small h bar, so as you were asking for large j, these things do approximate Hamilton theory. Now, since I don't want to oversell, let me say that in this theorem there are holes, there are details that, there are things to be fixed. It is proven in some cases, not in the general case, but I'm not going into this sort of technicalities. So these, there are theorems, but the, but they're also open questions. That's why there is a series of theories. First one, as I said, was proven in the UK by the John Barrett group. Laurent had a version here. There's a version of Bianchi and so on. But in any way, there's a strong indication, let me put it this way, like this strong indication that string theory is finite. There's a strong indication that there is the classical limit, the large J limit of these things is exactly the Regge thing. And then there are two results which are older. These are new. So in the 90s, which tell us, and which I'll say based on the Penrose spin geometry theorem, that the boundary geometries, the boundary values of this thing represent classical geometries, and that the boundary geometrical operators have discrete spectra. I'll come to that in a moment. But let me say why this might happen, because after all, this, where is generativity there? I mean, where is Ricci, where is Riemann, where is, it seems completely mysterious that out of that you can get something related to GR. Well, it's hidden here in this map from SL2 to SL2C representation. And this is the only sort of more technical slide. If you get bored, just sleep for 1 minute, I'll wake you up with the next slide. I want to give you a hint of what's happening. This is GR. This is the action. If you rewrite it in terms of tetrad and spin connection, that's the form it takes. An equally good action for the same equation of motion is obtained by adding this piece. That's a gamma, the gamma that is the real number that has appeared. This is a Mirti parameter. So this is like the theta QCD term. You have FF star plus theta FF. So it's like that. So it does not change the classical theory, but it's essential in this game for defining the quantum theory. So let's start from that. And look. Your variable is a connection, an SL2C connection, and it's an E. What is the conjugate momentum of the connection? Well, you have d omega here, d omega here, so the conjugate momentum is whatever is in front of it, so it's EEF plus 1 over gamma EE. So the conjugate momentum, which is something in the algebra of SL2C, so as the index structure of F mu nu, right, the Maxwell tensor, has this peculiar structure here. So like Maxwell tensor, let me split it into the electric and magnetic component, E and B. N is the normal to the, determined by the normal of the.
So what is that?
Sorry?
So what is that?
F? Oh, sorry, the curvature of the spin connection omega. Excuse me. D omega plus omega. From this structure, it's just a few lines of algebra to show that the electric and magnetic component of B are related by this equation. Okay, let's put this on a side. It's a collinear simplicity constraint in the jargon. And let's look at this definition of the map from SU2 to SL2C, which I have in the theory. Now, forget that. This is just the definition, the recall, how are the unitary representation of SL2C labeled. The point is that it's a simple theorem, simple lemma to show that on the image of this map, this is inside this representation of SL2C, so you have generator of boosts and rotations. On the image of this map, the generator of boosts and rotations satisfy this equation here, or more precisely, the matrix element of this operator here is 0, weak. So in other words, this map maps into SL2C representation where the conjugate variable to the group, so the generator, so B, has the property that tells you that it has this form here. If you drop this thing here, if you just replace this EE plus EE by B, you get a completely trivial theory, which is BF theory, in four-dimensional SL2C BF theory, and you get a a theory without degrees of freedom. What creates the degrees of freedom is this particular form of B, which is implemented in the quantum theory by this matrix. This is not a proof of anything, but just to tell you what is happening in the belly of the theory that allows this theorem here to actually work. Now, to prove this theorem is complicated because you have to write this, you have to work with two integrals, see what happened for large j, and you find that you can rewrite the integral in such a way that large j becomes a saddle point, and use a saddle point approximation, look at what are the equations of the saddle point equation, and you see that you get exactly to the Regen theory. Okay, so here we are. We have this limit pretty good under control. For each C, we have one of these theories here. And what is missing? Well, this is a geometry, gravity. These are just length, the variables, length of the Regge bonds, which approximate a geometry. How do I relate this SU2 boundary variables with geometry? Okay, and that's what next thing I'm going to tell you. And if you've never heard about loop quantum gravity, this is the moment to sort of wake up and see how it works in the small, because this is where the quantum geometry comes in. So on the boundary of these things, I have graph, right, at each given approximation, so at even given triangulation. The graph, the boundary of the two complex, or if you want, the graph dual to the three-dimensional triangulation of the boundary. On this graph, on each link, I have an SU2 element. So the Hilbert space on the boundary is L2 of SU2, and from the form of the transition amplitude, you see that there is this gauge invariant SU2 on the node. This is nothing else than the standard Hilbert space of SU2 lattice Young-Mill theory. Okay, so it's not an exotic object. And the electric field there is the generator of SU2 on each one of these SU2Ls, so the left invariant vector field. If you want it, because of this gauge invariant, it satisfies the Gauss law. Now, this object is not gauge invariant itself. It has a vector, a little arrow over it, transforming the vector representation of SU2. If you want to get something gauge invariant, SU2 gauge invariant, you have to contract two of them, the one sitting here and the one sitting there. So you have this gauge invariant operator on each node of the graph that depend on two links, okay, and that satisfy this property here because of the gauge invariants. And these, if you see where they come from, if you relate it to the generator of the conjugate variable to the connection, this is the metric. This is where the metric is hidden. And in fact, this is exactly on the Hilbert space here what Penrose in the 70s defined as the Penrose metric operator, essentially on something completely equivalent to this Hilbert space here, and showed that this Hilbert space with these operators here represent three-dimensional geometries, in a precise sense, in the sense that if you construct coherent states in these Hilbert spaces, these are described by variables, which are the same variables that describe the geometry of a discrete space. More precisely, to each node, you can associate a polyhedron. This G gives the angle here. The diagonal part of this G gives the area of each face. All right, so what? So in this Hilbert space, one can prove two things, and it's a little bit of math, and it's simple and pretty. And first, that the area of each face and the volume of each polyhedron here form a complete set of commuting operators in the sense of Dirac, like L squared and LZ. Okay? Therefore, there's a basis to diagonalize them. And it's easy to diagonalize the area because it's just a Casimir of SU2, so it's eigenvalues are a quantum number of spins, okay? So a basis in the Hilbert space is given by a spin attached to each one of these things, and then you diagonalize the volume, and you have the volume eigenvalues here. And it turns out, if you do that, that both are discrete. So the area eigenvalues are discrete, and the eigenvalue of the volume are discrete. So this object here, I'm defining, it gives geometries, but not geometries arbitrarily fine, only geometries large with respect to the scale of the theory, is J equal 1, which is a Planck scale. And this geometry is quantized in which sense? First, in the sense that the eigenvalues are discrete, so like LZ, L squared for angular momentum. And more importantly, because the operators themselves do not commute. The A and V commute, but the angle operators don't commute. So it's like the different component of the angular momentum, right? The LL squared and LZ are sharp, but LX and LY are fuzzy. So you can never write a completely sharp a state which gives this geometry sharp. You always have a state which gives a geometry up to quantum fluctuation in the small. You can write coherent state theory, and there is a big literature in the field about how to write this coherent state, which for large quantum numbers, large J, so big, you suspect the Planck length, you can approximate as you want, as well as you want a classical geometry. So these are the quanta. So this the quanta of space, the quanta of the gravitational field are not sitting in space, they make up space themselves, so to say. And that's the core idea of loop quantum gravity. So this is how to do a general covariant quantum field theory. Instead of having a space with a field with quanta living in it, you have the structure, and the quanta themselves build up space, like in classical general relativity. But the solutions of the Einstein equation are not living in space, they are space-time. Now, these are the eigenvalue of the area. As I said, it's just a Casimir, so it's just light. Here I was careful, put all the pi and everything. For each value, notice that there is an area gap. So it's from 0 you get to 3/4 here. The volume for each value of the area, this is was volume eigenvalues computed by Eugenio Bianchi numerically. For each set of area eigenstates, these are the volume eigenstates. So they can it's easy to show that the discrete and there is a maximum and minimum. So if you rewrite the transition amplitude, this is a partition function, in this basis, it all becomes discrete. It all becomes a sum, no integral here. And the sum is clearly summing over geometries, which are never very small. Okay? So in other words, this is a version, because of the other result about classically, this is a version of the integral over geometries, where, however, one is not summing over continuous geometries. One is summing over eigenstate of the geometric operator, which are discrete in the middle. I remember that Feynman constructed the path integral by inserting resolution of identities. So if the thing you're resolving is has discrete spectrum, then you have sum, not integrals, right? So this is where the ultraviolet finiteness come from. So here we are, and now I'm close to the end. These are the good news, now bad news, right? Because in a sense, you could say, well, are you telling us that the problem is solved? That, look, we have objects that in the classical limit go to GR, and they're finite, okay? And then order by order in approximation, they would approximate the transition amplitude of generality. And we know that order by order, as I decrease the triangulation, the H-bar limit of each one, they converge correctly to the Hamilton function of GR. So it seems that it's almost done, but as usual, no, the devil is in the details. Where's the devil here? The devil is, no, this is the regime where this expansion is good classically. So it's good, you don't need many affine triangulation if you're looking at lengths which are large with respect to Planck length and small with respect to one. So where is the devil? The devil is that, in fact, it's not true that, and if you think for a moment, it's obvious, it's not true that if you have a transition amplitude defined order by order, which are all finite and all have the correct classical limit, and the classical limit converges nicely, then you're done. Because what prevents the quantum corrections to be such that the approximation becomes bad? So in other words, when I go up here, I refine the triangulation and I go to next order, the correction I get is finite, but who tells me it's small? It might be large. So the H-bar goes to limit is converges, but the radiative correction, I don't know. So are the radiative corrections small or are not? And that's what is missing. So the radiative correction can be large. That's the point. It can be large because, remember, they are finite with a cosmological constant. Now, physically, the cosmological constant is large compared to the Planck scale. So in principle, I could get radiative corrections very large here. There's large numbers here. So if the radiative corrections, the radiative correction comes when in the two complex you have bubbles. You have faces that form a sphere. So if by sort of summing around here, this is the analog of the Feynman graph loops here. If I get radiative corrections which are finite but large, they might make the approximation itself useless. Not inconsistent, but useless. Okay. This is the open problem, and they may come both from large spins, and if I have a very fine triangulation, for many small spins. And I don't know the answer of that, and this is, I think, where the theory is not complete, and the person who is more more determined and is more advanced in studying what is happening in this direction is Bianca here. Bianca did. Okay, so I conclude with a slide of comments just to tell you about things which I haven't told you, and then a slide summary. This is my penultimate slide. I want just to say that I haven't said so, but the amplitudes are Lorentz covariant. I mean, there is SL2C there. So locally, everything is correctly SL2C invariant. In the way I've presented it, there is a preferred SU2 subgroup in SL2C, but in fact, everything can be shown that nothing depends on this subgroup. I've only told you about pure gravity, but you can extend the definition to fermions. It has been done to fermions and Young-Mills. And I've given you one definition of these amplitudes, which is group intervals. As I said, this can be turned around. There are at least four definitions in literature that look totally different, totally unrelated, but in fact they are the same. It's a state sum model, it's a sum over S2. S2 integrals and so on and so forth. So they can be turned around in all possible ways. Unfortunately, these are finite integrals, but are very hard to work with. The only region where it's easy to do calculation is the asymptotic in the large J limit. So that's what the... If I had more time, I would have talked about is what you do with that. I mean, these are transition amplitude for sort of three geometry to the geometry. From that, you can compute, you can do the same for any field. You can compute the particle endpoint functions. So you can start from a, you can put given geometry in the boundary. You have to tell the system that you're doing Minkowski. So you can put a state which is given Minkowski in the boundary, study the excitations of that, and compute the two-point function, the three-point function, the four-point function. This has been done in the Lorentzian, in particular by Eugenio and by others. And what you find is that you get back the two-point functions of the propagator, the propagator of general relativity, and the vertex functions, the three-point function and four-point function of general relativity. So there is Newton force, and things fall in this theory. And then the two large applications of the theory are these two, cosmology and kinematics. Cosmology is based on just the kinematics of this theory. It's essentially built on the existence of this area gap. And there's a huge literature. There are hundreds and hundreds of papers. I can summarize it by saying that if one uses area gap, one can rederive the Friedman equation. And one gets the Friedman equation with a correction. This in red is a correction. Rho critical is a density at the Planck scale. So if you do standard cosmology with this correction here, everything goes like usual till near the Planck scale, near the Big Bang, where you get a bounce. So this theory predicts quite robustly a bounce that replaces the singularity at the Big Bang. And then there is a large literature on using this kinematics and recently even the dynamics for doing black hole thermodynamics. The great expert is Eugenio Bianchi, so he asked him who is here if you want to know more about it. Okay, so that's a slide of summary of what I've said. I've sort of argued a lot around this structure for the theory. So the theory is defined if we have this truncated approximation, transition amplitude, so approximate transition amplitude at certain order, And what we want is that the classical limit of each one is a discretized version of generativity. So they quantize a discretized version or discretized version of field by order. It's the classical limit, and you recover more and more degrees of freedom going up here. This is the definition of the theory. The theory is finite. It has just a classical limit. So it seems that we're done, but we're not, because the convergence in the weakest possible sense, this doesn't need to converge in any strong sense. It can be asymptotic convergence. It can just be, we just want that the next terms, when we're interested in the regime in which we're interested, a small correction to the previous term, right? That's what we were, the QED. We don't know if this is the case, so we don't know if the expansion survives the radiative corrections. And this is where we are. Thank you.
Very good. Right on time, so we have time for questions. Let me start with questions from students. If the students have any questions. Yes?
You said we can put dark energy in the theory, right? Can we come up with a candidate for dark energy, or it's just putting it right now?
Yes, definitely. I think that we have measured the acceleration of the expansion, and this can have many causes. The simplest possibility, which is compatible with the data, is that there's a cosmological constant. Right. So the theory here is defined with a cosmological constant. In the classical limit, it gives the Einstein equation with a cosmological constant, and it gives an expansion. So if the measurements or the experiments or some good theoretical reason will tell us that some other explanation for the expansion is the correct one, we'll think about it.
Right. So you mean we put that cosmological constant by hand?
Various things. I put the Newton constant by hand, the Einstein equation by hand, quantum mechanics by hand, including the cosmological constant.
Okay. Other questions from the student? Yeah? Well, you're more grown up.
That's not nice to say that.
Slightly more grown up.
We're all students.
Okay, go ahead.
I?
Yeah.
Okay. So could you please explain how to reconcile quantization of volume with Lorentz invariance and general covariance?
Yes, thank you. This is something which is often confusing. Thank you for this question. It's very confusing because we always think classically. So we think that if there's a quantization of volume, let's say quantization of area, quantization of length for simplicity. It's not the case, but just to... this quantization of length, then there should be bits of length of this. So when I look at the system from a Lorentz, this is going to be Lorentz contracted. So then it's not the same eigenvalue anymore. Okay. Now, if instead you think this quantum mechanically, so this is not a theory of elementary classical physics, it's a quantum mechanical theory of the geometry. So if you think quantum mechanically, then the correct analogy to think about that is angular momentum again. Okay? So if you think about angular momentum, you look at LZ, and you say LZ is quantized in units of h bar or half. Okay? You say, wait a moment, this obviously breaks rotation invariance, right? Because LZ is half h bar, say. I rotate by an angle theta, and then LZ becomes contracted, because when I have the cosine of theta, it becomes shorter. So how is it possible? Well, you just think about your quantum mechanics, and you realize that when you make a symmetry, what changes continuously is not the eigenvalues, is the probability distribution on the eigenvalues, right? So the when you rotate and you make what you're not going to measure in this, you're going to measure in this one. So you will have a certain probability of measuring LZ and a certain h bar and a certain probability of measuring zero, so minus h bar. So exactly the same thing is here. So I'm not saying that in the universe there are bleaks of fixed area. I'm saying that in whatever system, reference system you are, if you measure the area in that particular, just talk about Lorentz transformations. If you measure the area in that particular Lorentz frame, then you get one of these eigenvalues, exactly like in whatever spin direction you're orienting your Sturm-Gerler apparatus, you're always getting just 1/2 and minus 1/2. And what changes continuous is the probabilities. I hope this answer, if you think for a while.
How to get a continuous limit? Like you have quantum theory and you can find continuous limit to classical theory.
Yes. So if you have a graph and you have this discrete state, you can construct a coherent state where everything you measure large with respect to the Planck scale is well approximated by a continuous classical geometry. So in the continuous limit, you recover classical geometries. You it's like, again, think about angular momentum. How do you, if angular momentum is quantized, how is it possible that these things rotate with LX, LY, LZ, all defined, because it's rotating like that? Well, they're all defined, but with a little uncertainty, which is very small because this is macroscopic, also the same happens.
Okay, Akin?
Can you please say something about how matter is introduced in this picture? Is it similar to lattice QCD? And do you have fermions on vertices, etc.?
Yeah. In fact, it is extremely similar to lattice QCD. It turned out to be, it took long because of some technicalities, because we have triads instead of the metric. So you can, on lattice QCD, you implicitly have the metric, so it's easier. So you just had to, but it's just lattice QCD, and which also show why the finiteness survives when you cap the matter. Because from the point of view of the matter, this is like having lattice QCD, where the lattice spacing is down at the Planck scale. And you don't take the lattice spacing smaller than that. If you look at the action with Young Mills and fermions, you would say, oh, yeah, this is like this.
Okay. What are the experimental implications of such a theory?
You mean the one we can measure today?
Or in principle, in the next few hundred years.
Okay, thanks. So the one we can measure today, nothing, of course, as far as I can see. In my opinion, I mean, there are many, many papers on that. So let me tell you just a summary of my opinion about that, which is if there is a chance to see effect is from this term here in the Friedmann equation via the full cosmological. And in the background radiation spectrum CSAM. There are people who are working hard on that, and there are even people who are claiming that they can compute exactly what in the left part of the spectrum, what little tilt would this give. There are other people who say that the calculations are correct, but the effects are far too small for being seen today. But that's, to me, the most closing. There were hopes at some point to see more. At some point, I got very excited when, in a sense, this is good and bad, right? Because this theory here is Lorentz invariant, which means that the hope of seeing things which are obviously break Lorentz invariant to the form Lorentz invariants, at least naively, are not there. Maybe there might be there, but maybe Lee has more to say about that.
This is your talk.
Okay. yeah. But Lee and I have been working together for 20 years and disagreeing constantly for 20 years.
Okay, Jack.
If you expand your aperture selection around a fixed background, Minkowski, which you suggested, you calculate a loop integral, graviton loop integral. Does that UV calculation, is it strictly local and microcosm, like renormalizable QED? Does it remain strictly local?
Uh, if you go to, not when you go to the graviton propagator first order, when you go to the
do a loop interval.
I don't know.
I wouldn't think so, because if it's strictly local, based on the local field operators, then the vertices must be singular,
point-like.
Singular delta functions, which
right.
cause divergences.
Right. So what the intuition of what happens here from the point of view of quantum field theory is that this gives a cutoff for the Planck scale, essentially. So it like there's like a smearing at Planck scale. So
it must be non-local.
Right. So there's a small Planck scale non-locality.
Otherwise, the
yes,
the coupling, the vertices would be singular.
Yes.
Which means it's divergent.
Yes. One of the things that has to be done, and is related to the problem, is to compute this two-point function here to the next order, right? And connect to the analogous calculation one can do perturbing around Minkowski and seeing whether, because to low energy they should give the same, and then at some point they should separate, but this is not enough.
Okay, more questions? There must be more questions.
It's one in the room.
Yeah.
Some young guy.
So I'm a student also. two questions. You don't seem to have a small parameter to expand it.
That's right.
So I think the analogy with string theory is not great, because at least in string theory you have the string coupling constant. So whereas there doesn't seem to be anything you can calculate as a expansion into small parameter. Or is that wrong? Is there any physical quantity I could
Sorry?
Is there any physical quantity I could calculate within an expansion in a small parameter?
Yeah. Let's go back to the harmonic oscillator example. When I do this way with this funny integral here, then I have an expansion in N. The expansion is good when this is small, when this divided by this is small. So I have a dimensionless quantity which I compute from my boundary data. So
in your case, you have external three geometries.
That's right.
And if those volumes, the volume of those three geometries is large in Planck units,
two things for the expansion to be good. It should be large in the Planck unit and small with respect to Weber's curvature.
Sorry, I didn't understand what R is.
Curvature.
I see. So the volume has got to be big compared to its own curvature.
Its own curvature.
Volume.
That's right. So that's right. The once you have boundary geometry, let's say in principle you solve the classic equation, you have the curvature, you have the full metric inside.
Right.
So you have a value of the curvature, and you have a curvature scale, which is sort of on which scale this change.
And
so
the L there is the L of the external geometry.
Yes.
So your claim is if I compute an amplitude between a big smooth geometry and another big smooth geometry, then I can reliably compute it in a semi-classical.
Perfect. That's exactly. And I believe this claim at h bar going to zero order in h bar. Well, I would like to believe the claim to high order in h bar, but I'm not sure.
So then the second part of the question is, can you do this on a computer?
If you means me, no.
Why is it hard to do it on a computer? It doesn't sound so...
Complex numbers.
Computers can deal with complex numbers.
Let me give you a technical answer. Because I don't know an Euclidean version of that.
Monte Carlo is not applicable.
Yeah.
What Laurent means is that...
You can't use Monte Carlo, but if you just do it as an integral.
Yasha Neiman is a young guy from is sort of beginning to try to do that. In principle, these are
integrals.
Well-defined integrals, and we know that they're finite. So in principle, you should just... these integrals are in many dimensions, which is SL2C, SU2, and...
All right.
So you said that, so now you're starting to investigate the radiative corrections.
That's right.
Is that a 5-year problem? Is that a 20-year problem? How much of a challenge?
No. It's a 1-year problem, as I knew 10 years ago when I started.
I got my answer.
It's hard. I mean, I was so happy when I had this interval. I know it's finite, I know it's well defined. You just have to compute an integral. So we are physicists, we thought how hard is to compute an integral. We are still struggling. I've given a lot of theses with the same title, and then they all diverge to something else because the actual, that particular calculation, or some one of those calculations, is always hard.
If I can naturalize, the technical achievements to get this far were formidable. Many of them are in the last few years. More questions? Jaime? No? Bianca? Okay, very good. Last call. Well, then let's thank Carlo very much. Carlo is here.